Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats.
It was here.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll have to delay just a minute.
Hi.
Nathan.
Oh, it's Peter. Okay, now we got eight. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the January 20th, 2015 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. I wondered if you would stand with me and please pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. A couple housekeeping things before we do the roll. Please silence your electronic devices and cell phones. The emergency exits are to my right in the back of the room and to my left in the front of the room. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera has asked to be excused. Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein has also asked to be excused. And Mrs. McBean Claiborne has asked to be excused. Mr. McKenna? Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa? Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here. Yeah, it was here somewhere.
If nine members present.
We have a quorum. Presentation of petitions, proclamations, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
We are going to have an executive session tonight to discuss a matter of particular personnel. I guess we can go right to privilege of the floor for the public. This is the opportunity that people have to come to speak to the Tompkins County Legislature about any topic. We ask that they fill out these blue cards, which are in the back of the room. If anybody wants to speak, and I have several of them already, please fill one out and send it forward. We allow 3 minutes, and we have a clock on the screen to my left. That will count down at the end. There'll be an audible tone. If you're still speaking at that point, we ask that you please conclude. The rules that are on the blue cards say that I agree to a 3-minute time limit. I agree not to raise my voice. I agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. I agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, I agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. I agree that if I cause a disruption and am asked to leave, I will leave the chambers. First one I have is Vonnie Dawson. And after that, Judy Pierpoint.
Hi, I'm Vonnie Dawson, and I live in Groton, New York. And this is a little weird because Lee's here tonight and he's usually not here. But I've been praying that maybe tonight I could touch somebody's heart like I did Phil Shurtleff's heart one night long ago here at the board meeting. God rest his soul. May he rest in peace. I've been helping with the benefits for Missy Katie and her two sons, Matthew and David. And I'm asking the board to please help, too. I'd like to request a few things from the board. We could use a copier, paper, if we could maybe use a copier and some paper in the county someplace to copy flyers and letters at requesting donations for the benefit, that would be very useful to us. If somebody could grant that to us for the benefits that are going to be taking place for the Katie family. Also, if somebody could please waive the 25-cent FOIL request fees for any information that's going to be requested on behalf of the incident that happened out in Danby, that would be very helpful, too. Missy isn't doing so well herself right now, as you can imagine, and what is really on her mind, and she's having a really tough time with it, is all her children's pictures, all her pictures, everything that's very sentimental to her are still in that house. And she would like these things, but they've been very contaminated with this gas. And I am just wondering if there is a hazmat team or something that could go in there and get these items for her and somehow decontaminate them for her. And if there is a way, if the county could have that done for her so that she could have these items that are really sentimental to her, because, you know, some things just can't be replaced no matter how much money is, you know, raised. Her baby things, you know, like the pictures and things like that. She really wants these things. She's sick over this. I mean, physically sick, mentally sick. And we don't need another incident like what happened out on Danby Road because she's sick over this. The other thing I'm asking, and this is why I brought up Phil's name, is one night at the board meeting, he was able to, and I know this is where I know the board members can do things that I request because Phil did it. I'm requesting that maybe the county could provide her and her two boys health insurance maybe for the next year to cover the medical bills that are now incurring as a result of all this, because she's racking up some medical bills herself because of all of this. And there is no health insurance. She lost her job as a result of this. And she's having to seek medical help and counseling, and the boys are seeking counseling. And if there's any way the county could provide her medical insurance, that surely would help. So those are some of the things I'm asking for. And I'm out of time. I just realized that. I'm sorry. You guys have a good night.
Thank you. Judy Pierpoint. And Sherry Corthus.
I'm Judy Pierpont. I live in Dryden. I want to commend Tompkins County and this legislature for being leaders in taking steps to curb climate disruption. You've passed resolutions opposing methane and LPG storage on Seneca Lake and supporting home rule as towns banned gas drilling. And in the new comprehensive plan, you've been responsible and courageous in setting greenhouse gas emission reductions. You've committed the county to reducing greenhouse gas emissions 80% from 2008 levels by 2050, 20% by 2020, just 5 years away. And you understand the urgency of taking action to avoid the predicted unlivable future. So to meet these goals, we've got to start right now to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Most urgently, we must prevent increases in fossil fuel use in the county. This includes gas, methane. Gas is no cleaner than other fossil fuels. Unburned, methane is a greenhouse gas 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide over 20 years, the very 20 years we have to actually make a dent in climate warming. Methane leaks from all stages of production, transmission, and use. Leakage cancels out any benefit of cleaner burning. To prevent additional gas use, we must not build the proposed pipeline from Dryden to Lansing. It would carry the astonishing capacity of 700,000 or more standard cubic feet per hour. It has both the short-term capacity to gas up extensive housing developments and industrial operations, and the long-term capacity to commit this county to using gas as its major fuel source for decades to come. It will be easy to hook up and get hooked, difficult to unhook once the infrastructure is in place and the money spent. It will discourage the conversion that we must make to renewable fuels. These are ready. We just need to learn about them and shift our perspective. Once the infrastructure of solar, wind, and ground and air source heat pumps is in, the fuel is free forever, not subject to the ups and downs of the fossil fuel market, something we are seeing now. There's no guarantee that there will be a steady flow of cheap gas. We will be locked into unpredictability. Conversely, we can predict what we can get with the mix of sun and wind and the Earth's heat. I urge this legislature to take seriously our commitment to reducing emissions, starting now. We have no more time to lose. I ask you to do everything in your power to not allow NYSEG's gas pipeline from Dryden. Let's see. So, just no pipeline, no more methane, please.
Thank you. Sherry Corthius, then Inchik Lee.
Can you hear me? Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yes. Okay. So I was coming to ask that you guys, there's this authorization to accept Department of Homeland Security grant, Department of Emergency Response. And I would ask you guys to maybe not accept that right now because there's like only nine people. I know that's a quorum, but this is a lot of $358,000 and the stuff that they have in here, the software system, the law enforcement training simulator, additional enhancements in the SPILM and HIP link, CAD system emergency notification and training paging modules, and then this countrywide CAD system with ortho imagery files. But I think looking at what happened in Danby, the reason we have that situation is because we've accepted so much from the Department of Homeland Security, and with everything that went on in Ferguson and all over the country, I mean, that's one of the things that Obama's administration is saying. It's got to stop. This is not what a local police force needs. We need community policing, as I've said every time I come, and the jail expansion, which I am against. But I did want to come speak out against, because there was one section which is this training simulator, a virtual training simulator that concerns me. And it's what it does, it's a high-fidelity training, immerses the user and elicits the true-to-life responses necessary to make your police training exercises as effective as possible. So I have problems with the term, what's effective, what's necessary. You know, that you know, can be ambiguous. So I just would like you guys to think about it, maybe not accept it tonight and put it off until maybe some more people were here. But thank you for your time. I just want to let you know. Thanks.
Thank you. Inchik Lee. Then Linda Partis.
Good evening. Hi, my name is Inchik Lee. I am a resident of West Dryden Road in outside of Freeville. I'm here tonight to very casually, I didn't prepare a report. Many of you read the article in Ithaca Journal regarding the NYSEG coming to the Town of Dryden board and presenting, and I'm always shocked at when I read the article. I was shocked to feel like I was in a completely different meeting from the writer of the Ithaca Journal. So I wanted to point out that as a property owner, the West Dryden Road project really asks me to give up my rights to a foreign national utility for something that I don't want, I don't need, and I don't want to condone, I guess. They're asking for an easement which is completely arbitrary and leaves us open and at risk for our future and into eternity. And they're also asking us to give up our rights forever. And I continue to pay taxes on this property, and I want everyone to consider how our eminent domain regulations really are not looking out for property owners. Just that, and to remind you that NYSEG is no longer your grandma's utility company. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Parks, please.
Hi, Hi, I'm Linda Parks. I'm also a resident of West Dryden Road.
Yeah, I believe you shut the microphone off.
Oh, well, that was clever.
Is it green?
I've got a green light.
Okay, you need to be closer.
Okay. I'm Linda Parks. I'm a resident of West Dryden Road. Is this?
Good.
Okay, thank
Get
you.
Get a little closer.
Get closer. Okay.
There you are.
Okay. So I distributed copies of the questions that we were attempting to get answered at the town board meeting. A couple of you were present, and I very much appreciate that. And hopefully you will support me in saying that we basically did not get our questions answered. NYSEG basically stonewalled us, and or they don't have a plan. They don't seem to know what they're doing, or they won't or can't tell us about it. They aren't treating people fairly. They didn't even answer basic questions. So at the very least, we deserve, and I would hope you might help us find some ways to get some complete, accurate information from NYSEG about this proposed pipeline. We all know it will impact many of us and some people that aren't even born yet for a very long time. And as you've heard and as we know, this proposal is way out of alignment with the county's energy plan. It will cause us to massively overrun our greenhouse gas reduction goals. So I would just urge that we all work together to evaluate how we can really effectively meet those goals. Some of the information that NYSEG provided, such as the volume of gas, it doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. At one point, they said that they would use only 5% of the capacity of this proposed 10-inch pipeline. It doesn't make sense. They're going to build a $15 million pipeline and use 5% of the capacity. It's not good business. They're trying to make, you know, they need to make money on these things. And, I mean, the ratepayers have to, we all collectively pay for it. So what they said didn't add up and didn't make sense. And we're still, frankly, in the dark as much as we were prior to Thursday night. So I just would encourage all of us to work together to figure out how to really reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We know that Sustainable Tompkins, other groups, individuals such as myself, are installing solar and other systems in that effort. There's many risks to this pipeline. There's risks to residents. We need truthful information. We have attempted prior to this meeting to get changes made to this easement, people that were perhaps willing to sign it with changes. That's gone nowhere. The Dryden Town Board repeatedly asked NYSEG Thursday night if NYSEG could provide an easement template which addressed liability issues, specified the details about the pipeline and the placement, and NYSEG repeatedly told us that they could not or would not do that. And I would just like to say that the meeting was recorded. It's long, but you can access that from our website. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Joe Wilson, then Joanne Cipolla-Dennis. If anyone else would like to speak, please fill out a blue card and send it forward.
A point of information, Mike, just for the record, what is the website you're referring to? Could we know?
Sure.
It's drydenpipeline.com.
Thank you.
Joe Wilson.
Good evening. I'm Joe Wilson. I also live in Dryden. I also attended the meeting last Thursday night, and I will echo, without going into detail, the conclusions that NYSEG lost an opportunity to be forthcoming and transparent and instead stonewalled and evaded the very common sense kinds of questions that the residents needed answered in order to decide with any assurance that they were doing the right thing if they were to sign an easement, either the egregious easement that's been tendered to them or an easement which is actually tailored to their circumstances and the circumstances of the town. And as was said a couple of times, or implied and said, NYSEG simply refused to commit to anything like that. In the same way, with the exception of some information that I think only engineers can understand about the capacity of the pipeline, its size, the rate of gas that will go through it, NYSEG was otherwise unforthcoming with regard to information. In particular, the information that I'm seeking, because of some apparent confusion within the community about the extent of the authority of the town and the extent of the authority of the county over the land in which the pipeline is to be constructed and installed, there, the NYSEG has been unwilling, I don't think unable, but unwilling to specify in traditional terms like meets and bounds or a scale map drawing where the pipeline is going. That's become significant because the town or some parts of the town administration believe that the county has authority through its power to maintain the county road, West Dryden Road, and therefore the town has no authority in that area. And on the other hand, the NYSEG is seeking easements in the private properties of the residents along the south side, where the town of Dryden, whether they were willing to admit their own laws say what the English language says it's, they say, gives the town authority. So there's a murky area in there. Where is the pipeline going specifically would help to clarify the whole issue of who has what authority and how it can be exercised. So in my final couple of seconds, I may have to come back and ask for additional information that you folks may be able to get your staff to get from NYSEG with regard to specifically where the pipeline is going and what authority, if any, the county has over those specific areas. Thank you.
Thank you. Joanne Cipolla-Dennis.
Hi. Good evening, legislature. Thanks for hearing public comment. I really want to support Vani's testimony to have some form of insurance for these children and the widow, Mrs. Katie. I really like you to treat that as a crime scene, what happened there. The police committed a crime that day, and I would like to have them investigated. There's two sheets of paper here full of names that signed a sheet yesterday in 2 hours' time to go to the AG. It has already been sent. Please support that. I'm a resident of Dryden and live along West Dryden Road, where Iberdrola of Spain, known as NYSEG, is trying to force eminent domain on innocent landowners by taking our land against our will, but would be happy to pay us a dollar to install a hazardous 10-inch steel frack gas line. That gas line, as was exposed, one of the things that were exposed by David Bovee, who's a representative of NYSEG the other night, was that this is a line that will have other lines coming off of it for Ithaca. One guy says, Bob Pass says it's for Lansing development. The other guy says, no, it's for Ithaca. So which is it? You know, this is the very same gas that all of us in this room supported not be fracked here because of its dangers. Part of that danger is pipelines. We know that from Dr. Ingrafia's studies. If you haven't read the study from Dr. Resnick, who studied the content of radon in the Marcellus, which is unlike the other shale formations in the United States, has 70 times the average. And I don't know about you, but when I'm cooking dinner, I don't want to be exposed to radon gas that could kill my wife and family, could explode my house. I don't want a pipeline near my house, and I won't be living near any gas pipeline. That's why I live in the country. I don't need it. My solar panels have provided me all the electricity I need. And for 5 months in a row, my electric bill has been zero. Zero. I cut my gas last year. I used it for radiant heat, but because it had doubled by the time I had built my house in 2007, started out at 169, went to 385, if you could get it last year, I saved almost $1,000 getting off of gas last year. I don't need it. I'm not going to use it. We had incredible growth, as you know, from Solarize Tompkins, which I volunteered to bring to this community the first time. And the second time, It brought 22 full-time living wage jobs to this community. Gas pipeline isn't going to do that. We need more growth in renewables, and we won't have that if we have gas pipe through this community. We have to say no, and I'm counting on you to continue your good work in renewable energy and leave the methane in the ground. We can't keep saying, no, you can't store it, and no, you can't frack it, but of course you can use it for dinner. That's senseless, and you know it is. So please stop supporting it. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm not seeing a municipal official for privilege of the floor by municipal officials. Let's go to privilege of the floor by...
I want to ask if anybody else wanted to speak.
Well, I already asked that. I said if there was anyone else who wanted to speak, they needed to send up a blue card. If there's anyone else who wants to send a blue card, I'd be glad to do that. Let's go to privilege of the floor for legislators, please. Anyone want to speak? You don't have to. Dooley Kiefer.
Thank you. I wanted to share information about something called the People's State of the Union. As you all, I'm sure, are aware, we get a chance to hear President Obama tonight if we get out in time. He'll be speaking at 9 p.m. tonight. But this is something specific for Ithaca, and it's actually happening in 150 places across the nation. It's people who are enthusiastic about talking with their neighbors in the community, to talk about the state of their community, the state of their state, the state of the nation, the state of the world. And it's going to be held at the space, that's Green Star's new space across from where their store is, on January 30th. It's at 6:30. If you go, you can have some free refreshments. And then from 7 to 9, people will talk. It seems quite informal, and you don't have to have experience in telling your story. Just participate. So that's one thing. On another, but not unrelated note, I think the last legislative meeting I talked about the death of one of my heroes. Tonight I'm going to talk about the retirement of one of my heroes. That's Lester Brown, who founded the Earth Policy Institute. He began as a tomato farmer in New Jersey. He worked in Africa and India. And what he learned about from simply farming put him on a different path. Having graduated from Rutgers, he decided he would pay attention globally to what's happening in agriculture. And he branched out to found the Earth Policy Institute. Most recently, in the last decade, he has issued various versions of what he called Plan B, how to save the Earth, addressing climate, addressing water shortages, food shortages, and so forth. He's 80 years old now, and he has decided to retire. There will be one last publication in the spring by this institute, and I hope we all pay attention and read it when it comes out. So he's been an amazing contributor to international dialogue. Thank you.
It's been pointed out that Irene Weiser is here. Irene, did you want to speak for Caroline tonight? All right. Just thought it was pointed out you were here. I didn't see you. You were behind somebody, and just wanted to give you the opportunity if you wanted to. All right. Thanks. Who else would like to speak? Jim?
You did. Thank you. I want to completely switch gears here. And I had occasion on Saturday evening to go to the Kitchen Theater and saw the play written by Rachel Lempert called Count Me In. And it clearly was almost, it was very autobiographical. It was asking a lot of questions like, what do you do with the rest of your life and all those kinds of things. But that's something you can learn about when you go see the play. But the highlight of the play for me was David Squires, who was in the play. and he played himself, which is hard to believe, but he did. And he did a great job. The actors and actresses in it were also very good, but David was outstanding. He never missed a cue, and he just, you know, for me it was well worth whatever I paid to get in there. And I had occasion to talk to him after, because it was opening night, and he said, being in a play is a really interesting thing, because he'd never really been in a play. He'd been around them. He said, you know, your life is not your own. He said, during rehearsal, I wanted to go to New Orleans and be with some friends, and Rachel said, can't do that. You have to be here. You have to come to rehearsal. And he said they talk in a language that he didn't understand when the director was talking to the actors and actresses. And he said it sort of reminded him of being around the county legislature. But it was a... And I said, well, it reminded me of... I don't know what they say, but David used to speak in a language that a lot of us didn't understand. But it was an amazingly good play, and if anyone has the opportunity, they should see it for sure.
Martha Robertson.
Thanks, Mike. I want to underscore what was said about the meeting at the Dryden Town Board Thursday night. It was breathtaking what NYSEG refused to say. I mean, they, David Bovey, the project manager, was at least, I think, forthcoming. I mean, we still had, there were still lots of questions. But Jennifer Negus and Bob Pass, the two who, Jennifer was the person who manages the easements, and Bob Pass is the longtime representative for this area, you know, public relations person for NYSEG. It was really breathtakingly bad PR, if that's what they were trying, you know, if it was just PR. They, you know, the town board asked, you know, 8 ways from Sunday, you know, couldn't you possibly just put in writing these things that you're saying in public? And why can't you put them in writing? And they kept saying over and over again, we negotiate with just with each individual landowner separately. We negotiate separately. And they wouldn't even say why they wouldn't do a new template easement. So the inescapable conclusion is that they can't be trusted. It just left you with that feeling that if they were going to hold by what they were saying in public, why wouldn't they put it in writing? This is typical how you do business, is you put things in writing that you commit to, and they refuse. So I was really disappointed in the behavior. The town board was polite. They used humor. They cajoled. They tried rewording it. The project manager did try to answer questions, but there are a lot of technical issues that people weren't really sure about. But just that issue on the credibility of NYSEG was really damaged, and they have nobody to blame but themselves.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Well, Peter Stein.
Actually, I had two things I wanted to talk about, both of them a little bit unconventional. I know we've got this convention that we never ask questions of the people who give from privilege of the floor. But there's one that's been bothering me every time I hear about this West Dryden gas line. Can't the people just refuse to sign? I mean, they have no power to make you sign it, and they can come up with their own conditions, right? Is that?
Martha?
Yeah, people can refuse to sign. NYSEG said on Thursday night that they were considering eminent domain. They have all along said, oh, you want to change the easement? Just cross out what you don't like, or, you know, add in something else. It's like, that just doesn't smell right. You know, I mean, anybody could cross stuff out and, you know, change a legal document. It's not how we do things usually. And so that's the suspicion that they've created. So apparently they don't care and are willing to just use eminent domain. And, it's unclear. They said it's an option. They've told other meetings in public that they're planning to do that. So,
Carol, did you want to respond to
that? Yeah, I just want to give specific information. Gas companies, pipelines, they have the right of eminent domain without having to go through a public body. I believe it can nod heads back there if they stay under certain limits. They don't even need to go to the DEC necessarily if they stay below the 125 PSI pressure. So they're literally at 124 they're proposing this at, which is still a pretty high pressure. And if they stay below certain
dollar value
mileage, the mileage determines what levels of permission they have to go for DEC, FERC. If it goes across state lines, it's FERC. So, again, across the country, pipelines are coming in for approval at 1 mile under the distance needed for the next, whatever the next level of approval is. So this is coming in, you know, if you wanted in the future to go from Freeville to a gas plant, a future gas plant at the site, it's like 16 miles. If you were going for the whole 16 miles at once, you'd need certain approvals because it's over 10 miles. This is 7 or 8 miles, and the other piece would be another 7 or 8 miles. So it's people aren't trusting this, but they specifically do have the power of eminent domain if they stay below 125 PSI without having to come to us, without having to come to the town, without having to go to a judge. At least that's what they're claiming. And I think it's one of the things that Joe Wilson was raising is, don't we really, is there a way, and is there case law that shows that there is some authority, should we choose to exercise it, for example, on our own, that they're going on our road, they're going on the town's, the town has some jurisdiction, but they're claiming that they don't.
Peter, are you done at this point?
No, I had something else I said. I only asked that question because I was curious, but I'm still curious. Over the weekend, I got sort of interested in Governor Cuomo's idea of a tax rebate. And I don't know if anybody else is interested, but I couldn't really exactly understand who was going to get it and who wasn't. And so I made a little chart, and I find it quite revealing. So I thought I would tell you about it. I don't think it'll take me very long to explain, okay? So.
This is a circuit breaker, right?
Circuit breaker, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Give me one. I need one. So. Anyway, in the chart you get, it's pretty simple, okay? It's not exactly right because everything is more complicated than you'd think. But I've talked about how much is a person going to get as a rebate. And basically, it's a function of two things. It's a function of how much money they make, and I've got that down on the vertical line, and how much money what your house is assessed at. And so if you know those two numbers, then you know how much money you're going to get back. Okay? So if you see this graph, you see that, for instance, if you go to the very top left number, there's a house that is worth $100,000, and the person that lives in the house makes an income of $25,000 a year. then that person is going to get $750 rebate. And then at the other end, if you have an assessment, your house is worth $600,000, and you make $275,000 a year, you're going to get a $2,000 rebate. So that's what this graph shows. Now, the thing I found interesting about it is if you look in the top left-hand corner, at the first line, you see only one number down there. For a $100,000 house, the only time you get a rebate is if your income is $25,000 or less. And then in the other one, if your house is worth $150,000, then you get a rebate only if your income is less than $50,000. Now, I found this extremely interesting because if you ask in the county, in our county, what is the mean or median value of an assessment, and it's $150,000. And if you ask what is the mean or median value of a family income, it's $50,000. So that sort of means that half of our county is all in those first three numbers. Okay, the less affluent half of the county is only getting between $750,000, they're getting about $1,500 or $750. But all the rest of those numbers out there are people who are more than the median income in both income and assessment. So to me, that was very revealing, because I have great sympathy for trying to reduce the taxes of people who have a house that's less than median value and income that's less than median value. So I support the governor all the way along in making those three, making a decision to give rebates to those people over there. But for the rest of it, to me, it makes absolutely no sense. There's no point to it. That here I've got a person that has a house worth $500,000 and makes $300,000 a year, and I'm going to give that person a $2,000 rebate. For that person, that $2,000 rebate is like this, okay? It's nothing. It's a $2,000 that's totally meaningless to that person. And to me, that's a really serious problem, is that what they're doing is taking this money and giving, I would say, something like, you know, half of it to people who couldn't care less about the money they're getting as a rebate. And it struck me as this is a crazy way to run a ball game. I mean, if they took away all the last two columns, I'd say, yay, that's a great idea. You should do it. Go right ahead. But with the rest of it, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. So that's all I have to say.
I point out, Peter, this is a proposal that's been made by the governor. It's not in law, and there aren't any checks on it.
Correct. Absolutely. But this is the proposal. And, you know, it should make sense as a proposal, even if it hasn't been adopted. But that's what I find.
Thank you. Now, I have Mike Sigler, then Nathan Shinagawa, then Jim Dennis.
Hi. Thanks, Mike. Just a few things. Thanks, Peter, once again, because I agree with you yet again. And I simply just don't understand why this has to be so complicated. Every single tax cut has to be put through like this grinder to figure out what is going on. How they can't just make this simpler, I don't understand. But so thank you for making this chart up, which helps me a little, but still. Going back to what Carol said, Carol, I got to tell you, it's my understanding that pretty much a lot of what you said is incorrect. The company doesn't have a power to do eminent domain, whether it doesn't matter what side the line is. They're going to have to go to a government agency to get that. It's going to take about 3 years to do if they decide to go with the eminent domain. I mean, it's not like they can just say overnight, oh, we can take this. I mean, there's a process that's involved in doing it. I don't know what that process is, but NYSEG says if they do have to go that route, it's going to take years, not let's just do this. With that said, I didn't go to the meeting at 7 o'clock because
I couldn't make a meeting at 7 o'clock in Dryden. But I've been to a lot of the other meetings. I've talked to NYSEG a lot about this issue at these, and they're public meetings, so it's not like closed doors. I don't have any information about NYSEG that isn't out there in the public already. I guess my understanding is from these meetings, they're going to come up short on the number of people who are going to sign off on the easement. I mean, it's basically they've got about 20 people who it doesn't matter what NYSEG says. It doesn't matter if it says we're going to go this route. It doesn't matter if it says we're going to hook up your gas line for free. None of that matters. There's an overriding issue, and that's we don't like fossil fuels. And that's fine. I mean, you have a right to do that. I mean, but going forward, that doesn't really leave NYSEG any place to go. There's nothing that NYSEG is going to say to these 20 homeowners that is going to change that opinion. So from that point of view, it's kind of like, okay, we can keep meeting with you and we can massage this and we can make you feel better about it. But at the end of the day, where are we? We're never going to convince these 20 families that this is something that should happen. It doesn't matter that this pipeline underneath this road is going to be assessed at $20 million and that they're going to have to, or however many millions of dollars, and they're going to have to pay property tax on that. None of that matters because it's an anti-gas, an anti-fossil fuel point of view. So if you hold that point of view, that's fine, but it's kind of like, well, there's no place to negotiate then from a NYSEG standpoint. So where are we with that? And that's, I think, why you're at an eminent domain kind of situation. Thanks, Mike.
Nathan Shinagawa. All right. Jim Dennis. Then Robert.
Peter, the only thing I will say in response to your pretty well-done sheet is that none of it works, even if it's passed, unless the government, the individual local government, gets under the tax cap. And if you're not able to do that in wherever government you are in New York State, you know, put this one up on the wall in the garage because it's not going to work. So,
Martha?
Mike, I would say you might be right. There are certain people who would never sign any lease. But there may well be people who would sign a lease that they trusted. And, you know, Linda Levine, for example, at the town board meeting was saying, like, try it. You might like it. I mean, try it. You might get more people to sign. And not that she was in favor of people signing. She was just frustrated at the lack of regard for the public. And that's, I guess, what is disturbing, is that a body that has a lot of authority and power in our community seems to be able to just muscle through and really, really treat residents with disdain. And that's what was just disturbing. So, listen, on the tax issue, I think, Peter, you know, some people are feeling that at least the circuit breaker is some kind of progressivity in the property tax. I think there's other pushback that says, you know, if this is supposed to cost $1.7 billion, if they just put that into Medicaid, it would reduce your property taxes for everybody. And, you know, that seems to be the governor seems to be coming up with every possible thing he can think of to avoid taking responsibility for state programs. So.
Will Burbank.
Thank you, Mike. So when Peter posed this question, I noticed a couple of the folks, Joe Wilson and Irene, had stood up offering to answer. And I would wonder if you, the chair would indulge us giving one of them the opportunity to answer if they would like.
Is that all right with everyone? Sure.
Irene Weiser, a council member in the town of Caroline. I did, a while back, call the Public Service Commission and spoke with attorneys there to find out answers to some of the questions that you've raised. And, in fact, Carol was mostly correct. There is no requirement for a DEC review. I wanted to add to that for the pipeline of under 125 PSI, there is also no requirement for Public Service Commission review. The only authority that the Public Service Commission attorneys were aware of is site plan review at the local level. Pipelines that are 125 PSI and larger that are within the state undergo what's called an Article 7 review. And that Article 7 review goes through excruciating detail of various kind of environmental impacts and how they're going to be managed. And it's similar to a municipality site plan review process. And so something that Joe Wilson was referencing earlier is that it does appear that Dryden may have that authority, although there's some question by the town attorney as to whether that's the case. But it looks to be that a plain reading view of the law shows that Dryden would have that authority. So that's what I know of in terms of answers to that question. Oh, one other thing is that the attorneys that I spoke with also indicated that segmentation, which is what that's called, when you put something in for one purpose and then build it out for another, that they do see that happen quite a lot, and that it wouldn't be unusual for a pipeline of this size to get put in under a local municipal site plan review and nothing more. And then if they wanted to increase the pressure through the pipe, which it certainly could withstand an increase of pressure, could then have basically a pro forma Article 7 review. So, and to the issue of eminent domain, utilities are a unique kind of institution in our state. They are allowed to have a monopoly, or an almost monopoly, and in trade for those kind of privileges, they are theoretically being regulated by the Public Service Commission. But as part of the authorities that they do have, they are granted eminent domain authority absent cooperation with a government authority. So, you know, if somebody wanted to build a ballpark, they would have to partner with the municipality to build the ballpark. Not the case for utilities. Under their special classification, they do have eminent domain authority. At least that's my understanding from talking to the attorneys at the Public Service Commission.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Sigler, then can we wrap this up?
I mean, I guess we can do this debate, but it's my understanding from NYSEG that for every challenge, they're going to have to fight, and it's going to cost them about $15,000 a pop. So I don't know who's right now, but it's my understanding that any public service cannot go in and just take your land. There actually is a review process that has to happen. You guys are telling me, nah, they're just going to build the pipeline. That is basically what you're saying. Not you, Martha. But that is definitely what Carol's saying, and that's definitely what I just heard, that now the Public Service Commission's really not going to say much, and that this company has the power just to build kind of whatever it wants. And that's, I don't know, this is not the case. At least if it is the case, somebody should tell NYSEG, because they don't think that's the case.
Carol, do you want to ask the county attorney a question?
I was just going to suggest that we ask the county attorney to determine for us what the eminent domain law is in New York State in this regard, so that we have information and not a he said, she said kind of.
Jonathan, you'd be able to look into that for us?
Yeah, I could look into it, but I doubt I can tell you the time period or the cost it would take for NYSEG to actually. Yeah, I can certainly look into it, but I don't think I can tell you the time period or the cost it would take for NYSEG to get eminent domain in any particular county in any particular case. Generally, there are different levels of review at the Public Service Commission. If you fall below a certain amount, you don't have to go to the Public Service Commission at all. Then there is like what they call if you are just over the amount, there is a quick form review, and then at a certain point there's what they call a total complete Article 7 review, which is a lengthier proceeding. Once you get those approvals from the Public Service Commission, then you have eminent domain through those, and if you fall below, you have eminent domain power. I mean, if you're a utility, you know, the time period, I'm sure it's more costly and more time-consuming if they have to go to eminent domain. Interesting question about whether it would pay for them to not go to eminent domain and actually increase the pressure on the pipeline or increase the length of the pipeline and go to the public service and avoid the eminent domain thing. So, you know, but I can't tell you what their cost breakdown
options are. Yeah, no, I was not asking you on the cost, just on the how the legal authority worked and the whether it's a fact that that utilities are unique in being granted the power of eminent domain without coming to the whatever municipality is.
That part's definitely true. It's all part of the Public Service Commission structure of utility permission. Or granting utilities, and it's unique. It's totally different than any other type of entity.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Jonathan. Can we move on? For my report tonight, I have some prepared remarks I'd like to read. It has to do with the appointments of committees for next year and a few other items. 14 strong and backed by highly capable administrators, department heads, and hardworking employees, Tompkins County legislators are poised to continue the people's work in a manner that is serious, progressive, and fiscally responsible. It doesn't get easier. While the national economy slowly recovers and our county enjoys statistically low unemployment, that figure paints too rosy a picture for the shrunken middle class and for the underemployed stuck in entry-level part-time jobs. Those jobs are often strung together in the never-ending struggle to pay a family's cost of expensive housing, food, and clothing. We need more good-paying jobs, and we need training for our workforce to ensure those good-paying jobs will be filled with county residents well-prepared to take up the tasks involved. For the third year, New York State unfairly saddles counties with its smoke and mirrors gimmick of real property tax legislation, each year tightening the screws even harder. For years, governors and state legislators from both parties have wrung their hands over state-mandated programs like Medicaid. They require them to be paid not from the state's broad-based income taxes, but from the county's real property taxes. It's alarming. 74% of Tompkins County's real property tax goes directly to pay those mandates that we do not control. Meanwhile, roads, bridges, law enforcement services, youth, elderly, health, library, and mental health programs, to name a few, all suffer from lack of proper funding. It's time for our state legislators to put their votes where their wringing hands are. It's no longer enough for them to shrug and say they can do nothing because it is in the governor's proposed budget. It's time for them to vote against budgets that contain unreasonable, unfunded mandates to be paid for by county residents' real property taxes. Working with the New York State Association of Counties and meeting with our state legislators, we must constantly apply the necessary pressure to get changes made in this unjustifiable travesty. In 2015, the Tompkins County Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee will be charged with keeping us on an even fiscal keel and with pushing back on unreasonable mandates and restrictions piled on us by New York State. Legislator Jim Dennis will chair that committee. In the personnel sector, the county continues to work with our employees' bargaining units to bring forth fair and effective labor contracts. Serving with Jim Dennis will be Michael Sigler as vice chair, Leslin McBean Claiborne, Peter Stein, and the new legislator who will be elected from District 9 on February 10th. Our county strives for the goal of being open and welcoming to all people. Above all, we strive for that goal within our own workforce. Our employees must feel included and appreciated not only for the service they provide for people of Tompkins County, but for the ideas they may suggest to improve how we serve the community. To lead our effort, the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee will be continued this year. Leslie McBean Claiborne will again chair it. The committee will also continue to include members from community and staff. Among other things, a climate survey for employees will be offered, the responses evaluated, and the statistics and recommendations shared with the legislature to help it form legislation and other positive actions. Our Facilities and Infrastructure Committee is charged with overseeing the condition of our buildings, highways, and bridges, and the solid waste programs. With road money in short supply, bringing together resources to work on the next phase of Ellis Hollow Road reconstruction and the multimodal project for Pine Tree Road, to name two, will be a challenge. Encouraging more reuse and recycling programs in solid waste will be on tap. Completion of the addition to the Human Services Building for the day reporting program is a priority. This year, I've asked legislator David McKenna to chair the committee, with Kathy Luz Herrera as vice chair, and Will Burbank, Dan Klein, and Mike Sigler as the other members. The Government Operations Committee reviews programs from administration to assessment and our operating policies as well. It will have a busy year again this year. Our airport program reports to that committee and will require serious and special attention to continue as continuing changes in the airline industry often negatively impact our airport's excellent service. Too many flight cancellations by airlines can erode our customer base. Those actions must be constantly addressed with airline managers to reduce problems. Wages paid by their employees Wages paid to their employees by contractors providing services for the county will continue to be reviewed as contracts are renewed. The goal continues to be having as many such contractors as possible paying living wages to their employees. Dan Klein will chair government operations this year, assisted by Nathan Shinagawa as vice chair and Dooley Kiefer, David McKenna, and the new District 9 legislator when elected. The Broadband Committee that reports to the Government Operations Committee will continue, and David McKenna will continue to chair it. Broadband Internet service for everyone in the county continues to be the goal. Efforts to obtain more funding to complete the project will continue. Our Health and Human Services Committee always has a full agenda. The social services and mental health programs that it oversees, as well as our health department, Office for the Aging, Human Rights, and Youth Services, are active departments. Special attention this year will include how youth services work with other municipalities, such as the City of Ithaca. Peter Stein has agreed to serve as chair of the committee for 2015, with Kathy Luz Herrera as vice chair and Carol Chalk, Leslie McBean Claiborne, and the new District 9 legislator being the other members. The Economic Development Committee continues for 2015 and will be chaired by Martha Robertson. Economic development continues to be an important thrust for our county, and Martha will be able to bring her experience to bear as a past legislature chair and former representative to the Regional Economic Development Council for the Southern Tier. Projects like the airport industrial development site, Chainworks redevelopment, and many other important projects throughout the county demand attention. At the same time, development needs to be guided by principles that can lead to more use of renewable energy sources. Joining Martha is Will Burbank as vice chair, and members Jim Dennis, Mike Sigler, and Peter Stein. Dooley Kiefer will chair the county's Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee. That committee has an important agenda of rolling out the update of the county's comprehensive plan. In addition, an energy roadmap is to be brought forth from our planning department, which will help chart a course towards renewable energy and lower greenhouse gas emissions. Working together, the planning department and the Tompkins County Area Development can assist us in charting a course toward both an environmentally friendly and economically developable county. Carol Chalk will be the vice chair of the committee, and Dan Klein, Dave McKenna, and Martha Robertson will be the members. Our Public Safety Committee faced difficult and sometimes heated controversies last year. It promises to have an active year in 2015 as well. I've asked Nathan Shinagawa to chair it. Emergency response to critical situations, jail program capacity, possible state changes in defense of indigents may all come to the forefront now and in the months ahead. Jim Dennis will be the vice chair, and Will Burbank, Carol Chalk, and Martha Robertson will be members. The Old Library Committee, a special committee, will continue in 2015 and meet as needed to review responses to the requests for proposals this spring. The goal is to present a final recommendation and have the legislature act on it this year. I will serve as chair again. The vice chair is Leslyn McBean Claiborne, and the other members are Dooley Kiefer, Kathy Luz Herrera, and Mike Sigler. The Charter Review Committee, also a special committee, plans to complete its work this year and propose charter revisions to the legislature. The charter is our county's constitution, and the charter itself requires a review at least every decade. I will chair the committee again. Dooley Kiefer is the vice chair, and the members are Kathy Luz Herrera, Dan Klein, and Peter Stein. To my colleagues on the legislature, let me conclude by thanking all of you for your hard work last year for the people we represent. Every year it gets harder and more complicated to serve. This year there will be lots of challenges, but with your goodwill, your ideas, and your remarkable service, 2015 will be a great year for our county. With my trust in the people, our employees, and in each of you, I am confident that we will go about our work and get it done in a manner which we can all be very, very proud of. Thank you. After we conclude tonight, we're going to want to try to take a stab at seeing if we can get our committee schedule done. So we're going to need to all wait around to do that. We're a little hampered tonight because we have some members who are out sick or not here tonight. So we'll have to do the best we can with that scheduling. In your package, you'll find as we do each year, a proposal that has been put together by our board staff, and that's a starting point. I'm going, Dooley Kiefer.
It was fun to listen to your plans for us for the coming year. We're going to be plenty busy. I hope that you will be willing to consider a possible change for where the airport is addressed, because to me it's so much an economic development issue that it seems more appropriate to me to have it in economic development than wherever it is right now. So I don't expect you to make any change right now, but I hope you will think about that.
Yeah, and I understand, and I've been weighing that, and I will think about it some more. Let's go to reports by our administration. Our county administrator, Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Mike, and I too look forward to working with the legislature on what is indeed a very aggressive agenda for next year. At your last meeting, I missed my second meeting in 6 years. I understand it was uniquely productive. It went quickly. You ended on time. So if anyone wants to make suggestions that maybe I stay away more often, I'm happy to entertain those suggestions and take them to heart. Just a couple of items, and I do want to make a couple of comments, too, on the circuit breaker, because it is an important discussion that's been put out there by the governor. But let me begin with a couple of other somewhat random thoughts. At your next meeting, we'll be presenting the accomplishments list, so I'd like about 10 minutes at your next meeting to go through that department-by-department list of the major accomplishments that have come out of our departments in 2014, with a hard copy that will come along with that. We've talked at length about the Workplace Climate Survey. Almost every meeting we talk about the progress that's being made on that. I can now tell you it's going to be released and put in circulation on the 9th of February.
It will be concluded on February 20th, and there will be an analysis and review of that. So thanks largely to Paula's efforts and a couple of very effective committees she's pulled together. We're making good progress on that. I do believe that we will be getting a copy of the final draft to legislators. I think it's late this week. Like correct call? Late this week. So Julie had brought that up at the prior meeting, and we will be planning to do that. sticking with the diversity topic, we have posted on our webpage the first annual diversity metrics report. You may recall that as a part of the diversity and inclusion policy that was approved back in 2013, there is one new requirement on my department, which is to develop a system of metrics so we can see what the profile of the county, the demographic profile of the county workforce is, and how that is changing over time so we can watch trends. And we can slice and dice in a number of different ways to see how we're doing in various categories and fronts. Those reports have been submitted to WDIC over the past 6 months or so, but we did do a year-end report to kind of encapsulate everything and summarize things, which, again, is available on the webpage. It might be interesting for you to take a look at, and we can also just email a copy of that to you. But I think you'll find it interesting to see the composition of the workforce, not only the existing workforce, but who we've brought in and who has separated from county service. All that is profiled in that report. I'm happy to advise you that the clerk has gotten another award. Maureen Reynolds was in Anaheim last week with several municipal clerks, town and village clerks, who you know she's been working with to expand the digitization of records initiative. So it wasn't just the county that took this on, but as we mastered that art, we then worked with towns and villages in the city to make that technology available to them. That effort was recognized at the Laserfish International Software Conference in Anaheim, an event attended by about 3,000 people. We were one of a very few communities that received an award, and ours was for shared services. So hopefully the governor is listening to know that indeed we take our shared services very seriously, and we're quite effective in doing that. So another pat on the back to Maureen Reynolds, the clerk staff, and others for the work they've done on that. Quickly, with respect to the circuit breaker, because a lot of the important things about that proposal have already been discussed tonight. It is a serious proposal. I think everybody knows kind of the skeleton Peter described them of what's been proposed, and that is basically if your tax bill exceeds 6% of your income, there you are in line for a credit on your income tax. As time goes on, we're learning a couple of details about it. It's a sliding scale. So at kind of the lower end of the spectrum, you are eligible to get half of the excess amount of your property taxes back. As your income rises, that amount that you get back, that share declines. So it's a sliding scale program. Based on the arithmetic that we've been looking at, it looks like in Tompkins County, kind of a rule of thumb will be if your assessed value is more than twice your household income, you might be in line for a credit. If it's below that, you fall below the threshold. So, again, we looked at our tax rates and other things, and that might be a simple rule of thumb for you to keep in mind as people ask about how this may affect them. Jim Dennis made the point, I think Mike did too, and it's the critical one. This comes only if you own a home in what the state's now calling a tax cap compliant community. So you get it only if we've hit our marks on the tax cap. I believe that means the tax freeze as well. So you recall the two marks that we have to hit. You have to stay below the cap. So call it 2%, but you know it varies from that. You have to stay below the cap. And under the freeze, you also have to show that you have taken action to achieve sustained savings equal to 1% of your tax levy. You have to keep going. So I believe to be a tax cap compliant community, both of those targets have to be hit. And unlike what the environment that we're in right now, which is if we stay within the cap, property taxpayers get a small rebate check based on the county's share of the tax. But if somebody else doesn't, if the school district, for example, wasn't able to hit their stay within their cap, we'd be okay. So our taxpayer, the county taxpayers, would still get a very small rebate check for the county portion. The way I'm reading this, and this still needs to be defined, it sure looks as if to qualify for that credit, everybody has to stay within their cap. Because remember, it's your total property tax bill, everybody's. Is it 6% of your income or more? That's it. So I believe it's a bundled approach this time. So everybody is going to have to stay, I believe, within their cap and within their freeze. You've read also that this applies to renters. It's a different approach. It's only if you make $150,000 or less if you're in line for it. I think the bar is much higher. Again, trying to figure out kind of back of the napkin, simple arithmetic, it looks like renters may be in line for a credit if their rent exceeds 45% of their income or so. So it's a pretty high bar. But at the same time, think about students who have very low incomes but still are paying rent. So that's one of the uncertainties here is whether, for example, our large student population would be in line for this credit. In terms of who benefits the most, it certainly skews toward downstate. So if you look at the expected average circuit breaker refund in Long Island and the metro suburbs, it's between $1,100 and $1,200. That's what the governor's office projects. They project for upstate $800. That would be ours. So the benefit is about 50% greater down in the Long Island and downstate area than it is in upstate, as I think we would all expect. In terms of concerns, they're obvious. One is we have to stay within the cap. Two is that job isn't easier because the state hasn't proposed anything that I've seen to reduce the mandated expenses that Mike talked about in his presentation. I haven't seen anything in there that is meaningful mandate relief that will help us stay within the cap. Now, imagine what will happen when we go into the next recession, and there's always the next recession. Think about what happened last time, where our revenues declined and our human services expenses went up. That means that we're going to have a very difficult time staying within our cap. And if we don't, our taxpayers lose the credit, and they're suffering from a recession as well. So it compounds the effect that they would experience as they're going through the recession if that were to go away. So as has been said, again, for what it's worth, my thoughts, it wasn't very long ago when counties said to the governor, step up and pay for at least a larger share of Medicaid and maybe just take it over. And the governor's response was, I don't print money in the basement of the Capitol. I don't have the money. Well, now what's being said through this proposal is we've got the money. We've got $1.7 billion. And I think, at least my perspective would be, that money is much better invested in shifting those costs back to where they belong, which is in the state budget, paying for those costs out of the $1.7 billion that the governor has now said he has, as opposed to a plan that is really going to cause, I think, great distress within local governments. And to the extent that were to happen, and again, it's been said already by you, the effect is broad-based. So currently the plan that's been presented is for some homeowners and some renters. If the governor is serious about property taxes being a deterrent to economic development, well, this would be a way that the benefits of this plan would assist small businesses, industry, everybody who pays property taxes, and not just one class of taxpayers. So it would serve the goals of the state also in trying to promote economic development. So these are early thoughts. My hope is to prepare a briefing memo for the legislature on this with a few more details. And again, Peter has gotten us started with his analysis. But over the coming days, I'll try to get some paper on this to you so things are a little more clear than they are right now. That's my report.
Dooley?
Joe, I think I read somewhere that the $1.7 billion that the governor is counting on isn't there yet. It's a projected savings in future budgets, which makes it seem that much weirder to me.
Yeah, and this has been proposed as a permanent circuit breaker. So again, if my sense is if there's a capacity to do the circuit breaker, and that's long term, then that same capacity exists to take over some of these mandates.
Peter Stein.
You know, one of the things that puzzles me about this whole thing is the, let's say the governor, what he says is what he thinks, namely that taxes are too high in New York and that it would be much better for the economy if local taxes were reduced. Why in the world does it have to be so complicated? Why didn't they just pass a tax cap with no override? Do you have any understanding of that? This is the screwiest thing I ever heard of. This is the same thing as saying you can't override it, but nonetheless, it's all mixed up with this other thing, and I don't really understand why he's doing that. Do you have any understanding of that?
Peter, this is one person's opinion. It is clear the governor believes that the reason property taxes are so high is because there are too many local governments who have grown too big. So this is a way to basically force governments to downsize, spend less, do what the governor thinks we should do, which is to consolidate and merge. I mean, I think it's a very strategic thing that he's done. If his perception is the reason property taxes are so high is because we've grown too large and there's too many of us, I think we around this table have come to long understand it's not the problem. I mean, the problem is that we're trying to pay our bills and the state's, and we can't do both with the property taxes we have.
Martha?
It's a political policy. It's not and it may be that rather than just say imposing a 2% tax cap, that in a sense he may have been responding to complaints by local governments and said, well, we'll do it. You can override or, be more flexible, which of course makes it more complicated. Joe, I think you're really on the right track, and I hope. I'd like to, and I left you a message today about setting up meetings when we're in Albany for NYSAC and NYSAC conference, and try to bring this alternative. I mean, it's just so complicated. It collapses under its own weight. I just want to say also, I think the freeze. We've stayed under the cap a couple times, and these are choices that we make. The freeze is really, do we have a chance in hell of qualifying under the freeze? Since they won't, it looks like they're not going to look at the consortium?
In terms of consolidations and shared services, no. In terms of other things that we're now starting to think about putting in the report and hoping they accept, one thing that I heard from other counties was when they refinanced old debt and they saved money, they're going to count that as an efficiency savings.
Okay.
And if that's the case, I mean, Rick will talk tonight about the refis, and we saved a fair amount of money by refinancing. We're starting to look at things like, since our drug copays increased over the past couple of years, it's a savings. Can we count things like that? So I think we can point to a lot of good things that we've done to reduce the cost of government, which we probably just look at as what we do in the ordinary course of business. But as we kind of peel back the onion and look at those kinds of things, we're going to look at that. We're working hard on shared services. There's a committee. We've talked about things that we're looking at. The truth is, the checklist that the state has handed out as examples of what can be done, we've done them. So it's going to be very difficult for us to hit our marks based on what the governor wants, which is shared services and consolidations.
Carol?
So two things. One, just a quick question. Do I understand correctly that it's the tax cap portion it's the circuit breaker portion that would be written in and go on into the future, but
yes.
The tax cap is still only a 3-year program at this point?
Well, I think the governor will extend, he'll propose extending it to be woven directly into what he's proposed for the circuit breaker.
Okay, so that could continue indefinitely, or that's what might still need?
The way I read what he has said, I think that would be a long-term connection between the cap and the circuit breaker. That's the way I look at it.
Okay, and the second had to do with this notion of whether we have a chance in hell of having the other jurisdictions in our county put us in a place where there's any chance we'd be eligible for any of our residents would be eligible for any of this. Our school district didn't come close. I think there were a lot of school districts around the state. I don't forget the percentage that didn't. But I'm also wondering what, assuming that that piece either were taken care of or was made a little more separate, whether there could be, and again, assuming Peter's assumption that the governor's got a rationale and that there might be a perspective that says, yes, this will put pressure, does this push us to more intermunicipal cooperation in the sense that rural areas, if there's a rural area, anybody who can't stay within the tax cap now, we would be all be encouraged to work together to a greater extent. If it's a rural area that has higher expenses and a smaller population, got to cover those expenses, or cities are notorious for just having higher expenses. It costs more to run a city. I mean, our city doesn't come close. So, are there ways in which we will be forced to look at, positively so, at intermunicipal cooperation, what kinds of things we can do together, what ways we might, take over some expenses to get everybody?
Well, that's what TCOG does. And so that's an ongoing conversation, and recently TCOG has said let's really double down. Let's take a very focused look at what else is out there. What else can we do? And as I said earlier, much of what is there to be done has been done here. So we're looking at municipal courts, we're looking at back office services, we're looking at things like that. But there's always more you can do. But I will tell you, we start out already having done so much that there's, in my opinion, not a heck of a lot left.
Peter, you want to wrap us up?
Yeah, I'll wrap it up. I think it's plausible what the governor says, that our taxes are too high. I don't see it, but it's plausible I'm told that we're the highest taxes in the highest local taxes in the nation. Somebody has to be the highest, but if it's really out of range of everybody else, maybe he's right. But frankly, the argument that the problem is the number of taxing authorities strikes me as being absolutely absurd on the face of it. There really aren't no great economies of scale. There may be small economies of scale, but to say that because New York City is 20 times bigger, 100 times bigger than Ithaca, therefore their government, their expenses are much smaller, you won't find that at all. You never find that. So I can't believe, he's a smart guy. I can't understand why he keeps pushing this idea of consolidation. I've never seen anybody give quantitative results that say, yeah, you save a lot of money by having a bigger city than two smaller cities. Have you?
No, and in fact, if I may.
I know Mildred Warner's thing that says the opposite.
Yeah, there's a lot of work that's been done on this, and that's exactly what she's concluded. There's some shared services that may make sense. We've shown that. But in terms of the grand consolidations, often those expect the savings just aren't there.
Jim, if you must, be short, please.
Yeah, Mike, I want to wrap it up. Two things. Number one, we need to talk to the legislators in Albany about this thing because it's in only Andrew Cuomo's mind right now. And secondly, if you want to look inside Andrew Cuomo's mind, then we're going to be here for a very long time. Okay?
Thank you. All right, let's move on. County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
My conclusion is the whole thing that in order to take advantage of the circuit breaker, I need to buy a more expensive house.
Our guest.
No, I otherwise wouldn't qualify. This is probably the last time I'll report this, but as some of you may remember, years ago, this county and numerous other counties in New York State started a lawsuit against drug companies for overcharging us on Medicaid drugs. And over the years, we've settled with the various drug companies for various amounts over, it's got to be at least 7 or 8 years now. But this morning, I received what they say will be the final check of the final settlement is $4,000. I'm not sure exactly what the total is of all the years of settling, but I think it's about $100,000. So it turned out to be a pretty good move from the county, although money's been trickling in, but today does seem to be the end of it for all practical purposes. But that seems to have been a successful endeavor over the course of many years. The only other thing I have to say is to remind everybody that I won't be here next board meeting, and the new deputy county attorney, Bill Troy, will be sitting here. That's my report.
Questions for John? We go to Rick Snyder, our director of finance.
The finance report tonight, I'd like for you to refer to a handout that I've placed at your desk. This is on the sale of bands and bonds, the long-awaited report that tells you how well we did in the last group of bonds that we bought. And I thought I'd put it in writing because
Rick,
there's so...
For the people at home, would you say what a band is?
Sure. The bands are bond anticipation notes, and they're short-term. They're like short-term bonds, and we only issue them for 1 year. You can do it for 1 year or less. But the report tonight is broken down into three portions. The first one, we're going to discuss the sale of the bands, which are the short-term notes. The second section is the sale of the new money bonds. And when I say new money bonds, I mean those are brand new bonds for brand new projects. And then the third section is the refinancing of the old bonds. We and the financial advisors composed a team that went out into the market to try to find which issues that we had on our books would make sense to refinance, and we found there were three issues. Usually we just do one issue, but we comprehensively wove three issues together, the 2005 bonds, the 2007 bonds, and the 2010 bonds, and we refinanced all those bonds into one new refinancing called the refinancing bonds of 2014. So if we start at the top of the report, I just wanted to bring to your attention that the sale of the bands is not the biggest part of the financing. We only went out for $3,240,000. And being that it's a short-term rate, you can see in the first paragraph, we got a fantastic rate. 0.2736 was the interest rate. Of course, now that's a maturity of just 1 year, and that's why the rate is so low. And if you're asking what those bands were for, that was issued to finance road construction for Ellis Hollow Phase 2. And the rate on this bands, when you calculate what we'll actually be paying in interest on all that money for the year, we'll only be paying $8,348 in interest for the whole year. So on the second part of our report tonight, we're going to talk about twice as much was issued in new money bonds. I wrote that our positive Moody's bond rating, AA1 stable, allowed us to sell $7.7 million worth of these bonds at a net interest rate of 2.414%. The term of the bonds was 15 years, or they retire on 12/15/2029. Now, if you want to compare what our last bond issue that was like this was like, we can go back and we can look at in 2013 when we did new money bonds, instead of getting a rate of 2.4%, we got a rate of 3.399%. So this year's rate was considerably lower. But those bonds were for 17 years. That took us out to 2030. If you go back one more year, in 2012, we floated new money bonds at a rate of 1.87% for a term of 15 years. So that rate was actually better than the rate that we got this year. The rate that we got this year, 3.399%, kind of falls in the middle, right in between the rate of last year and 2012. The county also sold, as I said in the first part of the report, $3.2 million in bond anticipation notes at an interest rate of 0.2736%. I have a comparison right below there that shows what the band sold at in the last two issuances. In July of 2014, which was just a few months before when we did these bands in November, we sold bands at an interest rate of 0.182%. But if you go back to July 2013, we sold bands at an interest rate of 0.358%. So once again, the interest rate this time for these bands that were issued in November was right in between, about halfway between the last two times we went out to debt for bands. Now, if you look at the numbers in the little chart there in the mid portion of the page, I've listed what the projects are for the new money bonds. The new money bonds, of course, were $7.7 million, and they consisted of these improvements: $1.6 million for facilities improvements, various buildings; $3.92 million for bridge replacements; and $2.185 for the TC master plan, which is currently under construction. You add that all together.
TC3 master plan.
You add that all together, and that's $7.7 million of new money bonds. And, of course, we were just closing that issue towards the end of the year, and I wanted to bring a report to you a little bit earlier than this, but with the holidays and everything, we kind of got pushed back to this meeting tonight. Now, I saved the best news for last. When Joe was talking earlier that we might, and this is not known yet, but we may be able to use savings from refinancings to achieve these goals for the governor's tax cap and that plan for the next year, I wanted to bring a report to you that showed you how much we saved by doing these refinancings. On November 6, 2014, with a bond rating of AA1 stable, we sold $18.69 million of public improvement refunding bonds. The net interest rate for these refunding bonds was 2.704%. Term of the bonds is 18 years, and that was exactly the same horizon as the pre-existing bonds. So we didn't shorten the length or the term of the bonds, nor did we expand it in any way. It was for the exact same amount of time, 18 years. To show you how this compared to the last time we refinanced bonds, which was just 1 year before, last November in 2013, we refinanced bonds then at the rate of 1.268%. But those refunding bonds was for a much shorter time period, just 7 years. So you can see we got a better rate last year than we did this year. But again, the reason for that primarily was because of the shorter term. The proceeds of the bonds went to pay off the 2005, the 2007, and the 2010 bonds, which had an aggregate par amount of $20,685,000. And if you turn the page to the last page of the report, this is the best news. The county achieved savings of $2,410,737 over the life of the issue. The present value of that savings is $1,959,622, or 9.5%. The net present value savings was 9.5%. The county has a rule of thumb that we typically look at before we do a bond, a refunding bond issue, we have to meet that threshold of meeting 3% present value savings before we would proceed with a finance, with a refunding. So having far exceeded the 3% threshold, we actually got a savings level of 9.5%. From a budgeting perspective, and this is the good news for Joe as he starts, you've already got our next year's budget done, don't we? No, it's done, all right. But we, from a budgeting perspective, it will save the county approximately $134,000 per year on average. So we were very fortunate to sell the bonds when the market rates were at one of the lowest points for the entire year. Again, that $134,000 of savings, you might remember what it was last year when we did it in November for those refunded bonds, and I believe 105 to 110,000 in that window of savings. So when you add the two together, the annual savings that we have is close to $250,000 per year. And I'll take questions if you have any questions. If not, that's the end of my report.
Carol.
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate this report and laying it out so clearly. Can you talk to me about fees? What do we pay in fees? Who gets them? And then how big a difference in percentage rate do you need to get to cover the difference? Has it impact refinancing?
Are you talking specifically about the refinancing bonds?
Well,
the fees
for each
that are
of involved? Them. Would it make sense to consider, at what point do we consider just carrying, instead of bond anticipation notes, carrying that on our own books and waiting until we can just do the new money bonds?
Well, that's part of our goal as we, each year as we achieve these savings, you'll note that we don't move these money into any operating account or any operating funds. It stays in the capital improvement project and the bond refi and the bond payment funds. So all the savings that we generate help us when we go to put together next year's rendition of the capital, the 5- and 10-year capital project plan. And when Joe looks to what the annual debt service will be next year when we put the budget together, those numbers will have changed from what's in there right now. They will have gone down. And this is a way that we achieve savings so that your goal of what you mentioned there, perhaps not having to float bands or paying any interest rate, by building a threshold, a capital reserve, so to speak, large enough so that we would be able to loan money to ourselves. We would be able to have enough money for the projects that we could fund a project such as what we did the bands here for the Ellis Hollow Phase 2. And we would have enough money that we could front all the expense. And then when it was done, we would float bonds to cover it. Right now, most of our projects are short-term bands up front, and then they turn into bonds at a later point in time. And it is a lot of work, and it is a lot. That's on our plate when we're doing 2 and 3 bond deals each year. I'd rather just do one, honestly, and make it good. But what we're looking at in the bands here over the last 2-3 years at least, the rates that we get for this for short-term money for 1 year at 0.27% or 0.18%, it's just so low. You almost don't want to not borrow money. I mean, it's almost better to use their money than it is your own money at that point in time because the interest rate is so low.
And the fees, the percentage?
The fees, I can speak. I can't tell you what the fees are for the new money bonds. Those are fees that the financial advisor gets, the underwriters get, the bond attorneys get. They're usually a certain number of basis points. You know, they tell you how much of the total issue. And I forget what it is for the new money bonds, but I can tell you for the refinancing bonds, the fees are already net of the savings that I've given to you here tonight. So when we project the savings, this is after all the expenses have been paid because the underwriters, the financial advisors, all the people who print the documents, all of that gets paid first before we calculate what the savings might be. And so that is what you're seeing here tonight in number three is net of all the fees.
Okay. Jim?
Rick, thank you very much for this very comprehensive look at the things that we're doing with our bonds and having almost limited knowledge about all of this except what I've learned in local government. A perfect storm happened, and these kind of rates only come once in someone's lifetime, I think. And it could be very different a year from now based on whatever the economy is in the country. So thank you for your work and for doing these things this year and last year.
I would second that as far as this is a really great report. We can't just do BANs forever on a project. Aren't we limited to 5 years?
Yes, you're limited to 5 years, right?
Okay. All right. Can we move on? Resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda. Anything?
Carol? I just have a question. There's a revision to Resolution B in people's packets. That was what passed committee tonight. Minor change, but it replaces what you got in your packet in Resolution B.
Okay, is that okay with everybody, or you want to pull that off?
It's not on consent, according to this.
Sorry, I thought it was on the consent agenda.
Right.
Never mind. All right. Before I go into the consent agenda, I meant to do something on my report, and I want to just announce it. It's time to think about our poet laureate again, and we are in the process of choosing a new one, which is done through a group sponsored by our Community Arts Partnership. And we have a communication from John Spence, who's the executive director over there, looking for a legislator to serve on that group, to pick one. I don't think this is a long-term commitment, but I wondered if anybody would like to volunteer for that. And if so, please see Kathy Covert or Karen Fuller.
Leslin usually does that.
I'm sorry?
Check with Leslin.
Okay. All right, let's go to the consent agenda. We have some appointments to read. These are for the advisory boards. Out of the Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, the Environmental Management Council, Kenny Christensen, Daniel Kopko, and James McGarry. For the Water Resources Council, Elaine Quirani, James McGarry, Elizabeth Cameron, Sharon Anderson. For the Agricultural and Farmland Protection Board, Edwin Scheffler. To the Fish and Wildlife Management Board, Paul Tater. To the Planning Advisory Board, Fernando de Aragon and Martha Armstrong. Out of the Public Safety Committee, for the Criminal Justice Advisory Alternatives to Incarceration Board, Louise Miller. Out of the Government Operations Committee, the Library Board of Trustees, Rochelle Prajansky, Christine Utschuler, and Molly Salke. And we have one resolution. If anyone wants it off, just say so. Resolution A, authorization to accept Homeland Security Grants, Department of Emergency Response. That's ID 5336. Okay, are we ready to vote on the consent agenda? Do we have a motion? Motion by Martha, seconded by Dooley. All in favor of the consent agenda and the appointments, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That seems to be unanimous. Thank you. Let's start into our standing committee reports. This will be the last report from the 2014 committees, and next time there will be reports from the new 2015 committees.
I wonder if we could do peaks so Ed can go home.
Well, I think that might be nice.
Unless he wants to stay.
Let's at least move the Resolution B. Carol Chalk.
Do you want me to do it or do you want to do it?
No, it's your, okay. It's out of your committee.
Came out of committee, yes. You'll recall that that we last year decided to move forward on this feasibility study for the DOT facility, and it just the state didn't finish back and forth the contract work. So it's going to happen this year. So this is just moving the money into the 2015 budget. So I'll move Resolution B, Docket ID 5342, Feasibility Study on New York State Department of Transportation, NYSDOT, Maintenance Facility Relocation, 2015 Budget Adjustment. I so move. And it's the one in your packets that came out of it.
Is there a second, please? Seconded by Peter Stein. Discussion. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Carol, anything else on your report?
No. Thank you to all of the members who served so well and faithfully. And thank you to Ed for steering us through the last year.
All right, we'll go back to the top, to the Health and Human Services Committee. Peter Stein is the chair.
Well, let's see. We did have a meeting, but unfortunately, only me and Will were there, so there was no quorum. We had an interesting discussion, but I don't think you want to particularly hear about that. No actions were taken because there was no way of doing so. And now, after that, I have to announce when the next meeting will be of HHS, and I have no idea. That's my report.
Any questions for Peter? Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. I guess we go to Dave McKenna as the vice chair.
No report. I wasn't here, and I'm not sure exactly.
Anyone from that committee want to report? Thank you, Dave. Economic Development Committee, Will Burbank, chair.
Thank you. The committee has not met. We are done. And look forward to it. It's taking new activities under its new chair. That was my report.
Thank you. Questions for Will? Government Operations, Nathan Shinagawa is the chair.
Yes. Was our appointments done under consent or do we have to?
Yes.
All right. In that case, I do not have a report. I look forward to serving as vice chair.
Charter review. We did have a meeting, and we talked about both the probation section and the Department of Social Services section. We got through both of those. Next time, I think we're going to be talking about the financial. What's that? The financial procedures and controls section of the charter. Any questions? Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis, chair.
Wow. I have one resolution. It is resolution C, and it is a request for authorization to extend the additional 1% sales tax rate in Tompkins County, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley Kiefer. Discussion? Martha Robertson.
Somebody a while ago put under my thing here the business card for Frank P. Proto. So, and sitting in the seat, I almost feel like I should vote against this just because, you know, Frank would, but I won't. I just wanted to mention, remember Frank.
Frank put it there.
Frank put it there, okay.
Jim Dennis.
I will remind you, a loss of this, if this is voted down, we lose roughly $10 million. So think about that.
You mean our budget goes into deficit for that amount of money.
Exactly.
We don't really lose it. I mean, it's like... ready to vote on this?
We need a roll call.
All those in favor of this, please raise your hand. Any opposed? Mike, are you pro or?
No.
All right, so that's unanimous. Anything else, Jim?
No, other than I would, the people who were selected for the committee, I would ask them when we get together at the end, I'd like to keep the meeting the same Monday, the fourth Monday at 4 o'clock. And so far, we don't have anything for next Monday's meeting. So already, you don't have to come to the first meeting.
How about the second meeting?
I don't know. We meet once a month, fourth Monday, and that concludes my report. Thank
Questions
you very much.
For Jim. Old Library Committee, there's no report. Public Safety Committee, Jim Dennis, Vice Chair.
What? Nate, do you want to start it out?
Or
do
you you were
okay.
It was not in attendance at the last meeting.
Okay. let me just say, all of you who were here for or weren't here for the presentation by the sheriff and many of the other people who were involved with the Hornbrook Road event, I believe that time was well spent. A lot of things were talked about. We got a timeline, and while there were extensive questions from the audience that many of which were answered during the presentation, and legislators had questions and many of those were answered. I believe that I am fairly confident at having spoken to the sheriff and the undersheriff that 4 to 6 weeks from now that we will get another report. It will be a wrap-up, comprehensive report based on all the evidence they have, all the things that they did, and all the results from coroners and the like that they can put together and present to us. And if the legislature is willing or wanting, they will come and talk to us as a group about the report that they will have. So that's what I have on that particular meeting. And let me just say, from my own personal point of view, I've been in local government, 22 years easily, and it was the most intense meeting that I've ever been at. I've never been in a meeting like that, and I've been at meetings about development and budgets and all kinds of things, but that was one of the more stunning events that I've been at. And I thought it went off fairly well, the public and the people around the table who presented the information to us. So at any rate, I cede my back to the chair of the committee, Nathan Chinagala. But that concludes my report.
Nathan?
So Jim, with that report, since public safety met already this month, are we anticipating that perhaps by the next committee meeting that they'd be able to have this done? I mean, 4 to 6 weeks is not a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I think that, depending on when we do our next committee meeting, I'm trying to aim for the third Monday of the month.
Yeah. I mean, that might be a little too soon to expect it. Because there are things, a part of it, that we don't have any control over when the information gets to the sheriff.
Okay.
And the other. So I think the next public safety meeting might be, not the right time, but clearly after that.
All right. Thank you.
Will Burbank.
Carol, did you have your
hands? Okay. Will Burbank, then Dooley, then Martha.
Jim, I was not able to attend that meeting, but I was able to watch it from home. I want to thank you for having it, or whoever arranged to have it, cable cast. It was a very interesting meeting, and I thought you did a wonderful job of keeping it together, moving forward. A huge amount of information was brought forward that is on our website if anybody wants to see it. There are still questions that I think remain to be addressed, and I'm sure it will be moving forward. We tonight had a request from a member of the public on a matter that relates to that incident. I don't know what the proper way would be in terms of answering that or to whom those requests will be forwarded. But I would just take note that we did have a request for some kind of help. So,
I wrote down the four requests that I heard, and some of those are impossible for us to do, and others, it would make sense to me that if I were this person, I would be at DSS immediately looking for whatever DSS could do for the widow and her children at this point.
Julie?
Thanks. Nate, the rest of the agenda at the last Public Safety Committee meeting did not get dealt with.
Oh, okay.
So there's plenty there, and one of those items actually was to be a discussion, our initial more in-depth discussion of body cameras. So I don't know whether the sheriff can turn his attention back to that, but that was one of the things that we never got to. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that the consent agenda resolution A actually had a correction in the final resolved, which it didn't get pulled off of consent because it didn't seem necessary, but I think it should be publicly stated that the final resolved gives the county administrator authorization to execute contracts.
You're right. I'm sorry I neglected to give the county administrator his due on that.
I had one other item. Will, I too made note of the various requests that we heard, and I think that the one dealing with FOIL fees should be discussed at government operations, if any place. Whoever is chair of government operations.
Dan.
Okay.
Dan.
McMahon isn't here. Okay.
Can I have Martha?
I want to add my thanks to Jim for chairing a tough meeting. I had Joe, you and I talked about the widow and DSS. There has been communication there.
There was, yes. So there was a quick reach out by DSS. I think the mental health folks were also involved. And there have been subsequent attempts to connect with the family. I'm not sure if they have been successful or not. There are certain confidentiality requirements that DSS has to respect when they talk to me, but I know that we have made efforts.
Okay. All right. And just if I can just a minute on something else that's been in the news that the governor, I guess, may talk about tomorrow, was the proposal to charge to stop charging 16- and 17-year-olds as adults in New York State. New York and North Carolina being the only two states that still do that. And we've heard about this in public safety meetings in past years where that what that means then is if somebody's 16 or 17 and charged with a crime, they go into the juvenile system instead of the adult system. And there are certain, from the young person's point of view, that's all to the good, I think. But there are certain repercussions in terms of cost, family court, probation, et cetera. So I think it's the right thing to do, and I hope we'll hear at some point about maybe at the NYSAC committee meeting on public safety, maybe we'll hear about that kind of detail about whether there's any adjustment on local responsibilities there.
We're beyond our time for a break. I thought we were going to kind of finish this up, but I have Jim's hand. I have Peter's hand.
Jonathan?
I was just going to say that puts 16 and 17-year-olds out of the DA's office and into my office. So that's one budgetary effect there.
And I was actually going to say that because Gwen talked about that at a meeting, a budget meeting that we had. I remember her talking about that. The other thing Julie brought up and it's is the body cameras and car cameras for the Sheriff's Department. That's a discussion that is ongoing. It will be ongoing. And the sheriff, the last I heard, was
was supportive of that. So we needed to fill in the blanks about the, all the implications, not only cost, but the implications of people wearing cameras. And so that has not gone away, and Nate will pick that up.
Sounds like a great
immediately.
Peter?
I withdraw.
Okay, should we go to Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee? Leslin couldn't be here tonight. Is there any other report from that committee? Just let me say one thing, and that is I want to thank all the people who have served so hard on the committees this year, the chairs and the vice chairs. And the one thing that I've noticed this year is I think a little better working relationship between chairs and vice chairs. I think that's healthy. We've had committees where we've lost chairs, a chair, and the vice chairs have stepped right up to that. And I know certain committees that the chairs and vice chairs work and plan together. I think that that's a good way to proceed. I'd like to see more of it in 2015 here. The next thing I think I have is the minutes of the previous meeting, January 6th. Someone want to move those? Peter, is there a second? Is there a second? David McKenna. Discussion? Carol?
Yeah, I just want one word I'd like to correct, if I may. Packet page 17, the Government Operations Committee resolution. But my remarks, Ms. Chalk, referenced to tentative dates for the budget retreat and other meetings and requested a meeting wizard be done at the time these meetings are to be held. I requested a meeting wizard be done for the time these meetings are to be held. I don't mean, didn't mean to wait okay. until then to do it. Do
I think
it
that
now.
Should be corrected. Dooley?
Yes, on packet page 8, minutes page 2. In the fourth paragraph, the last line is me speaking. It says, she also stated, he puts a good face on the county he represents. I'm concerned about the phrase, putting a good face on, because that can mean making something up, hiding something behind a good face, and that's certainly not what I meant. So I would prefer it to read, she also stated, he is a good public face for the county. That was more what I meant.
Any objection to that change? I have no objection.
Does he really have a nice face?
Thank you.
I didn't say nice.
All right. Ready with those changes? We're ready to vote? All in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Martha.
I just... Before we break, or I guess go to executive session, whatever, I want to point out for the public that our next meeting is not a Tuesday. It's Thursday, the 5th of February, because of the NYSAC conference that several of us will be at. Right, Kathy, it's the 5th instead of the 3rd. So I'm also looking at our calendar schedule, and I might ask, because economic development, if we stay on the first Monday of the month, then immediately we'll have a problem with the NYSAC conference. So we look to change that one meeting.
All right. Any other unfinished business? Okay, so here, the game plan is now we're going to move into executive session to discuss a personnel issue, which I don't think should take an awful long time. We plan to come back. We will adjourn without taking any action that I'm aware of. And then we're going to stick around and see what we can do about committee schedules. Okay? So I need a motion, and we'll take 10 minutes after we move in, before we start the executive session. Someone want to move to go to an executive session? David McKenna, seconded by Mike Sigler. All those in favor of doing that, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Okay, thank you. We'll shut down the cameras at this point.